Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode isn't brought to you by Ron Swanson. I don't have to know what a podcast is to know that it isn't worth my time. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me is James.
Hello.
How's it going?
Good.
Good.
It's right. Good. We've discussed this. Today's going very well.
Yeah. Well, now we're discussing it in front of a microphone.
I know, but you should know.
Okay.
All right. Because I told you. But yes, listeners, everything is great.
Yep. And let's move on to our topic.
It's dragging it out.
It's because you don't give me, like, it's because you say good and then don't say anything else.
I know.
And then I have to say, so, and you do the intros for this, so I don't know.
Helpful, eh?
Yeah.
Anyway, speaking of great things.
Yes.
You like fried chicken.
Oh my God, yes.
You're a big fan, eh?
Yes.
And I know that because you live nearby to some decent chicken places.
Yes.
The most famous one that nearby would be Popeye's.
Yes. Although I think Jerk King is really making it.
Oh yeah, they're going to be big. Yeah. I know you prefer them, but I don't know if they're quite the same scale yet.
They're across the street. It's the same thing.
But I have a question for you.
Yes.
Do you know where Popeye's got its name? Because it's not the character. I always thought when I went in there, I'd see like Popeye the Sailor Man all over the place.
No, I guess my assumption was always just the person, you know, like, Colonel Sanders was from Kentucky, or yep. Maybe there's a Popeye in Louisiana that came up with the chicken idea.
Oh, well, I will solve this mystery for you.
All right.
The person who started this chain started with one location and took the name Popeye from James Doyle's character from The French Connection.
Nice.
It wasn't like, I'm going to name it after this guy, but he heard that name and he really liked that name and named a chicken place after it.
That's
and then the chain expanded and now there's one down the street from you.
That is spectacular. Because I would have, like, the first time I saw Popeye's, I probably would have thought about that.
Yeah.
And then just been like, you know, totally dismiss it. Because, you know, I just always think of movie characters when I see it. You know? But
well, now Popeye's is a little bit cooler.
Yeah. So we're talking about the French Connection to that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not fried chicken. This isn't our fried chicken podcast,
no. That'll come later. When we're totally out of ideas, so we'll do that.
Yeah, French Connection, 1971.
Mm-hmm.
Well received at the time. Still pretty well regarded.
Yeah. People like this movie.
Yeah. But yeah, when it came out, it wasn't that expensive to make, but it certainly.
It was $1.5 million budget, and it came in at like $1.8 million.
Yeah. And it made, you know how much it made?
80?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is 1971 dollars, but.
Yeah, exactly.
Still.
No, it's
even more so. It's a fair like chunk of
70 times your investment. You know, it's doing all right.
And critically, it did well, too. Got some Academy love.
It did. It won Best Picture, right?
Yeah, it got five wins. Best Picture, Best Director, who is William Friedkin.
That's right.
We'll talk a bit about.
Yeah.
Best Actor, Gene Hackman.
Sweet Gene.
Yep. Best Adapted Screenplay and Best Editing. Best Film Editing.
Yep.
And, yeah, deserved? What do you think?
I think editing totally deserved. I think that there's probably an argument to be made that this isn't the best movie of 1971, but looking at the other, I looked at the other nominations last night, and, it was best of those five, for sure. Okay. I mean, I didn't do, like, any deep digging, like, what big movies came out in 71, but,
yeah.
I like this movie a lot, though, so.
Okay, yeah, and, as I said, like, received well at the time, made a lot of money, critical love, even a sequel was made.
Yes.
Years later.
Yeah, 1975, I think.
And there was a made-for-TV movie based on the character. And there's kind of another indirect sequel with Roy Scheider playing a cop and I don't even know what they're called. Stuntman? Whoever designed the car.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I think Bill Hickman was the driver, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, did really well for like in a lot of ways, really had a cultural impact, clearly, if all these other kind of spin-off projects and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, still kind of like really well-regarded today. I mean, AFI still put it top 100 movies ever.
Yeah.
And it's really good. And you said you're a big fan, eh?
Yeah, I like it a lot. I hadn't seen it since like high school, and I remember not loving it mostly because I couldn't follow it. And I mean, that problem still exists a little bit with me, but I always loved the chase. I remember loving the chase the first time I saw it because I watched it because I was told there was a good car chase in it.
Yeah. Very famous car chase.
Yeah. And, when I was watching the movie and I was like, when's this chase coming? And then I realize it's not two cars, and I was like, oh, because that's what's really cool about this chase.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it is a pretty great chase. And, but stylistically, the movie's amazing and I love it. But,
yeah.
Yeah. I think that's part of the reason why I couldn't follow it when I was watching it again this time, but I watched it a second time and I was sort of piecing it together. But this movie really doesn't dumb anything down. It's really quick.
And yeah, it is.
And it doesn't stop to explain anything to you.
Yeah. And I didn't really notice this till someone pointed it out after, but there are stretches of this movie with little to no dialogue.
Yeah.
Like they don't really spoon feed everything. And there are parts with the chase scenes and stuff, and not just the famous one, but some of the foot chases and stuff, mm-hmm. just minutes at a time of just action or yeah. just things happening.
Yeah. And it's pretty great.
Yeah.
But do you like this movie?
I do.
Okay.
And I had seen it once before when I was pretty young.
Yeah.
And the only thing I remember was, and this is about halfway through the movie, maybe even further, is when they find the drugs in the car.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they all look beat. Like, this, you know, clearly the drugs aren't in the car. Yeah, I've checked everything but the rocker panels. And they checked the rock. And that was the only thing I remember from yeah. this movie of thinking how silly that was. And
yeah, I know.
Watching it again, I was like, yeah, that it's, really was dumb.
It's still really silly. But, yeah.
Like, they just looked like defeated. Like, they've been sitting there for an hour with nothing to do.
Well,
I've done literally everything except this one thing.
Well, do the one thing!
I know. And it seems like a really decent spot to store. Like, it's yeah. a long, hollow yeah. thing. I don't know. That's all I remember. Then I watched it again. And yeah, I still enjoy it. Yeah, I like it a lot. Gene Hackman.
Yes.
Our star.
Yes.
Popeye James Doyle, as we said. Or
yeah.
Or James Popeye Doyle.
Okay.
Any reason for that name? Did you ever come across
No.
this?
Okay. I mean, I didn't really do a whole lot of research about the movie.
Yeah.
Like, just sort of stylistically and stuff like that.
Yeah. But. And, what's his name? Cloudy?
Yeah, Cloudy. Which
is, and his name's not, last name is not McLeod, which is the only thing I could think of to explain that.
Played by Roy Scheider, who is an actor I always forget I really like.
Yeah.
Like, every time I see him in something, I'm like, I like you, Roy Scheider.
I like him. He just doesn't do anything for me in this movie because the character doesn't do
anything.
No,
exactly. It's the character.
Yeah, this is pretty much Gene Hackman and a bit of a French guy.
Isn't it Fernando Rey?
Yeah, Fernando Rey. That's the one. But yeah, you do you like his performance in this? I mean, best actor.
So. Gene Hackman, yeah. This isn't, I mean, it's not even anywhere close to my favorite Gene Hackman. Well, I guess it probably isn't in the top five, but I don't think it's a particularly great performance. I think he's done better for sure. But yeah, and I don't see anything that's like definably great. It's just Gene Hackman.
Yeah.
And I love Gene Hackman, so of course I love his performance, but you know, it's not my favorite Gene, but I like him. He drives the movie and, you know, he's the central character.
Yeah.
So I like him quite a bit.
And you think that's just what Gene's probably really like?
No, no. Although Gene Hackman is a very, he's a man, you know, like he is a capital M man.
Yeah. How so?
In that, like, I was reading, there was a GQ interview with him in January this year. And the person asks him, and he's 82 now, the person asks him, the interviewer asks him, when was the last time you punched somebody? He's like, oh, it must have been 10 years ago, which would make him 72 when he last punched somebody, which is amazing. But that was sort of like a minor incident. That was after like a traffic accident. He punched somebody in the face because he was just getting pissed off, which is just like a manly thing to do, you know? But yeah, Gene Hackman's very a manly type of guy, you know?
And for our young listeners, if you want to be considered a man, punch people in the face.
No, be barely... 71 and punch somebody in the face. Okay.
After being Lex Luthor three times.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you like him more as a villain or a good guy?
I think good guy because my favorite movies with him in them are when he's playing a good guy. I mean, I guess my favorite performance of his is Royal Tenenbaums. And he's... What?
Is he a good guy in that, though?
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
I think he straddles the line. I think by the end of the movie, he's a good guy. But the movie's very much about, well, he's Royal Tenenbaum. The movie's about him and how these people have sort of fed off of him. It's about family structure, that type of thing. And I think he's spectacular in that movie. But other than that, my favorite movies of his, he's the hero. And I mean, you could make an argument, he's not a great person in The French Connection, you know?
Yeah, that was gonna be my next question. Royal Tenenbaum is definitely, you know, on kind of both sides of the line, as you said, straddling it. I don't think that Popeye here is necessarily a strictly good guy.
No, and that's one thing that's interesting about the movie is that the only person shown being particularly racist in the movie is our hero, quote unquote, you know? Yeah. And something that William Friedkin mentions in the commentary is that, and I mean, it's obvious if you've seen the movie, that they tried to make the cop, look less, you know, less like a less classy guy. It's, I mean, it's all summed up in that scene with the drug dealer where, Hackman's outside of a restaurant watching, Charnier, who's the Frenchman, just have this wonderful classy meal with like four courses, coffee, dessert, you know, all that stuff. And then Roy Scheider just brings him a slice of pizza, you know. Yeah. It's just, he's just out standing out there freezing.
Yeah.
He's just like, you know, the drug dealer is a classier guy who's got a wife, and treats her well. Whereas Hackman is Doyle is a womanizer and all that stuff. So, there was a very conscious effort to sort of frame them that way.
Yeah, he's racist. He seems to be more concerned about saving his career and making himself look like a good cop than he is really about stopping these drugs. I mean, it never really seems like he has a moral objection. I mean, he must have a moral objection to drugs or to be in, you know, the narcotics line of work. But he never seems too hung up about the damage these people are doing. Or, you know, you don't hear any much mention of the victims of these crimes. It's more about his... you know, his goal.
And I agree. I think he cares very much about solving the case. I think, it's just more about obsession. Like he's just totally obsessed with it. I agree with your points, but I do think he desperately cares about solving this case.
Okay.
Or like catching the bad guy, you know?
Okay. We kind of just brushed past, Roy Scheider.
Yeah.
And his character isn't, much of anything in this one.
No, he's like textbook sidekick. He's the good cop, you know, good cop, bad cop.
Yeah.
And they play good cop, bad cop at the very beginning.
Yeah.
Movie,
in that interrogation scene. And, I mean, it certainly bears mentioning that this movie's based on a real case.
Yes.
This was, the French Connection was a real thing. In real life, people were bringing heroin in from France through New York City, the pier and stuff like that. And even down to the cars and hiding them in the rocker panels, which they actually really did a lot of in real life. Yeah. And,
They got away with tons of that before they actually got caught with the rocker panel thing.
Yeah, exactly.
That was my perception of it.
Yeah. So there's two cops named Eddie Egan and Sonny Grasso, who Doyle and Cloudy are, you know,
based off of.
And yeah, and you know, it was based on a real case, and so they even helped out with the movie too.
Yeah. And Eddie Egan has a fairly sizable role as an actor.
Yeah, they both play cops, but yeah, Eddie Egan certainly has the much larger role.
Yeah. Grasso just basically says, "I'll take a ticket to Washington," and then sits on some steps.
Yeah. Did you hear that story about Egan on the set arresting somebody?
Yes, but I'll let you explain it. It's good.
No, go for it.
Okay. Well, I think it was when they were shooting the chase scene or something.
It was the subway
or
one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Egan saw somebody, he was on set, you know, and, Egan saw somebody look suspicious. So he sort of followed the person and ended up arresting them for drug possession, which is really funny.
Yeah. Very awesome. Like what a badass cop, even when he's making a movie, he's still copping it up. But I guess I really like that subway scene. I think that deserves some talking about.
Oh yeah. It's spectacular.
Yeah. Kind of in these chase movies, because what genre would you call this movie?
I'd call it an action movie.
An action movie? Yeah. Okay. There's not... I mean, yeah, there's chases, foot chases. Maybe not as explosive as modern action now, but...
Yeah. I think that chase sequence, the car subway chase, I think is pretty incredible for 1971 and really, like, gets your heart pumping even now.
The L-Train.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I was very invested in that. And the foot chase with Charnier on the subway, which happens just before, is... It's more clever than like exciting, but it's a great scene.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not, I mean, it is actiony, but it's, you know, it's more of like a thriller, kind of like a spy cop movie kind of scene.
Yeah.
You know, if cop movies, not really a whole genre to itself. I would call this action too, but it is kind of slower and cop, more of a cop movie.
Okay.
But, action movies and cop movies and spy movies and stuff. You always hear the term cat and mouse thrown around, but like
Friedkin,
that subway scene is just exactly that.
Friedkin, when that scene starts in the commentary, he says, "And this is the movie's cat and mouse scene."
Oh,
that's
he?
Exactly what he says.
Oh, okay. Because it's such a great example of a cat and mouse one, and it's so well executed, and they're just both pretending not to see each other. And
they clearly both know the other's there.
Yeah. I forgot that scene almost entirely and was very happy watching
it. It's a pretty great scene. And I like that it sort of starts because Popeye just happens to be, just sort of runs into him, and while the cops are supposed to be watching Chardonnay are just talking in a doorstep, you know?
Yeah.
I enjoy that sort of like, what are you doing? Okay, I'm in this, you know? Like,
yeah. But yeah, I said, you know, it's kind of slower and quieter maybe than a, you know, full 100% full on action movie.
Yeah. I do think this is a very fast paced movie. Almost to the detriment of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I was going to say it's quick, and I mean, people still get hurt and die, and there's fights and accidents and stuff like that. But yeah, you said it's cut maybe too quickly.
I don't know that it's cut too quickly. I think it just, we'll put it this way. The writing is not the thing I like about this movie because to be perfectly honest, I mentioned this already. I had trouble following the movie until I watched it the second time. And I mean, part of it was getting caught up in visual things that I didn't recognize before and that are just really interesting to me. But it is a hard movie to follow. You don't know who that French guy is at the very beginning of the movie. And I had no idea until I read that it was an undercover cop watching Charnier. It's just sort of like, it's one of these things that happens sometimes when things are based on a true story where people assume you know what was going on or whatever. And, and I mean, it does move very quickly. How much time passes in this movie is a question because I think it's a couple years.
Yeah.
But the movie does not get that across.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess my understanding is the real case was like 4 or 5 months or something.
Oh, okay. Well, then, but obviously I'm wrong then.
It isn't necessarily that's what they were doing. But yeah, you really don't get a concept of how long they've been on this guy.
This movie does not take place over a week. No. I'm pretty confident about that.
Yeah. And yeah, he's always kind of intent on going back to France. So you can tell, you know, time is passing.
Yeah. And I mean, I should point out, I do kind of like that about the movie. I like that it doesn't stop to explain things to me. And I mean, I rarely like somebody, we mentioned in the Mystic River podcast, the over exposition that drives us crazy, but, you know, just a little bit more time for us to sort of piece things together. Cause there's just no time to think during this movie. It just keeps going.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, keeps going, like keeps moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not too long. It doesn't.
No, God, no. It's absolutely not too long.
But yeah. It's pretty action front to back. And yeah, it does lose you a little bit sometimes. One part that just messed with me was when he meets up with that French guy on the island near the start and he grabs that thing.
Yeah. I forget what it is, but
it's like an oyster or something.
Yeah, it's
just this weird unexplained thing that never gets mentioned again. Yeah. And there's just a couple. Yeah. I just agree that there's a couple parts that, you know, leave you in the dust a little bit, but you're supposed to be trying to keep up.
Yeah. I mean, no, exactly. I think the idea behind that, like if someone were to try and justify that to me, a producer or something, when they're making this movie, is that we want to put people in the place of sort of like someone surveilling the scene or whatever, you know, like we want them to be finding things out. We don't want them to know what's happening.
Yeah. And I mean, Popeye and Cloudy are detectives. It's what they do. They piece things together and, you know, make the most of what you've got. Did you know Peter Boyle was almost the lead guy?
I did. Yeah.
And did you hear his reason for not taking the role of Popeye?
Yeah. He was in, what was the name of the movie that he was in?
Joe?
Okay. Yeah, it was sort of this, it was apparently an anti-violence movie that everybody took the wrong way. And
yeah, that's how Peter Boyle took it, at least.
Yeah, Peter Boyle thought it was an anti-violence movie. I haven't seen it.
I haven't. But I mean, he seemed to think that everybody took it the wrong way, was my understanding of it.
Which happens sometimes, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so he kind of got seen as a kind of pro-violence guy or someone who doesn't really, you know, care one way or the other. And I guess that wasn't him.
Yeah. He just wanted to stay away from the violent script. I mean, he ended up being a Taxi Driver, so
yeah.
But I mean, that's you know, there's the violence debate about that movie. But anyways,
yeah. But his justification for not taking this role was that it glorified violence. Mm-hmm. Do you think this movie does glorify violence?
No, I think it's a violent movie for the time. Absolutely, it's a violent movie. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what his objection would have been specifically. I could have just been sort of. Maybe he was just being cautious. Could have just been that. But I would have liked to see Peter Boyle in this role. I think that would be cool. Yeah. I like Peter Boyle. I mean, I certainly don't like him as much as I like Gene Hackman. But
yeah. You said it's pretty violent for the time. And I was looking at the posters for this movie, and there was one that said, the time is just right for an out-and-out thriller like this.
Okay.
First of all, I do not like that tagline at all.
So the time is not right for a tagline like that, is what you're saying.
Not in my opinion. The time is never right.
Well, we weren't born when that was a tagline.
I guess not. Yeah. So What do you think they're going for there? Is that just something that, you know, they thought sounded good? Or do you think that this really is kind of a product of its time? And that, I mean, we have to look at Clockwork Orange, Dirty Harry, both coming out right around these times.
Yeah.
Do you think this is... I mean, Dirty Harry, another kind of gritty cop movie. I know you don't like the word gritty. But
I hate the word gritty.
I know you do. And I read it so many times today and was like, I'm going to try not to say gritty. Yeah, do you think this is kind of, you know, a backlash to the lawless 60s with crime and everything? Or do you think this is, that's just, you know, a phrase someone in the marketing department thought sounded good?
I think it's more the latter, but also, I guess, because... No, I think putting this movie in the same breath as Dirty Harry is sort of, I don't like that idea because Dirty Harry to me is the Miranda rights. It's like, this is the backlash to the Miranda rights is what Dirty Harry is, where okay. It's like criminals have rights. You have to read them their rights. You can't just kill them. And then Dirty Harry goes around just killing people.
Yeah.
And that's whereas I don't think Popeye is like that. I think Popeye wants to arrest Charnier more than he wants to. I think he's just one of those cops. Yeah.
Yeah.
He'll shoot him. I mean, he'll shoot somebody. Prove this in the movie. He'll shoot somebody to avoid them getting away
he'll
from him.
Literally shoot someone
but
in the back.
I think if the option was murder a person or arrest them, I think he would choose arrest. But yeah, maybe I don't totally agree with that.
He seemed to be pretty happy to kind of give Charnier the wave and kind of be like, yeah, you know, at the end, like,
oh yeah, no,
you. He does seem to very much enjoy sticking it to him. I guess he probably couldn't have shot him right then and there with so many people around, but...
Yeah, and, I mean, there's a conspicuous lack of paperwork that he has to do after he shoots the guy in the subway, but, yeah, I don't know. I think Doyle is a far more interesting character than Dirty Harry, though, because Dirty Harry is just so...
It's just a
he's such
gun
like a, he's a
walks around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just kind of looking at it in the history of, you know, when this movie was made and kind of the era that it came out of. It was also part of the neorealist movement
yep.
in the early 70s.
Okay.
William Friedkin was a big part of that. And people kind of say that that was, you know, very much a product of the times.
That's what I was thinking when...
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a 1971. It's pretty inventive visually, I think. And Friedkin's talked about... He was mostly influenced by... this movie Z, like a political thriller.
French film.
Was it? Yeah. Yeah. Costa Gravis was the director's name. And Breathless, which is, that one's Godard, right?
Yes.
And another French film. Yes. And it's very much, it's a really interesting movie stylistically because, it's French Connection is sort of shot. Friedkin basically explains it that he wanted to shoot it as much like a documentary as possible. And there's a lot of handheld work that you don't see a lot in early 70s American movies, and except for movies where they were sort of allowed to take chances. Like, this wasn't the general way of things being done. Yeah, you get a lot of shaky handheld in some scenes, and the camera operator, not the director of photography, but the camera operator had a background in sort of documentary filmmaking. He was actually like on Castro's right, like Castro's documentarian during the Cuban Revolution.
Really?
Yeah. Enrique Bravo was the camera operator's name, and so they would block out the scene without the camera crew, and then in the French Connection, they would block out the scene without the camera crew, and then Friedkin would just tell the camera operator to follow the scene. And that's how the movie gets its visuals, is that the camera operator doesn't totally know what's going to happen. It's got an idea, and then the camera just sort of follows the scene. And I think that's, you can really see that once you know it and you watch it again, but I think it's really cool.
Yeah, because this movie did strike me as kind of, I mean, realistic visually, like this kind of, you know, a believable way with not a lot of crazy cuts that really take you out of, you know, pretending you could actually be there.
Yeah.
And then reading about it, I kept seeing how documentary-like it was, and that didn't strike me as much. Maybe that's probably just me being used to when movies now are close to documentaries, it's so much handheld, and, like, I'm used to TV shows like The Office and things like that where the mockumentary or the documentary really does look a lot more like a documentary. Like, this movie looked more like a documentary than other similar movies of its time, but compared to a documentary, a real documentary, or kind of the mockumentary stuff we're used to, it's still very much like a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, like, there's no talking heads. I think And I mean, there's huge differences in technology that they're able to use on The Office than they
obviously.
On The French Connection. And I would imagine, like, I haven't seen a lot of documentaries from around this time period, but I feel like for the most part, it's fairly decent job of capturing that idea. And it's sort of like just documenting a scene where nobody's actually reflecting on it later. It's just sort of, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I like that a lot. And they shot a lot of things without permits and stuff too, which I
The car chase scene, man, that sounds like a such a mess from the description of it.
It's so crazy what they did. The car chase, there's this one, the whole car chase, they shot basically as much as possible without stunt cars.
In, like, Brooklyn.
Yeah, exactly.
During the day.
the craziest part being that these are my favorite shots in the sequence, and I don't seem to be alone here, is the ones where, basically from the car's point of view, there's a camera, like, locked onto the front of the car, and...
Yeah, like the front bumper, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And they just drive basically as fast as they can through traffic. And when I say through traffic, I mean, like, through actual traffic. These weren't... they didn't have a permit to do this. They weren't stunt drivers. They were just pedestrians. Or, sorry, not pedestrians. But, you know, regular people driving cars.
Motorists.
There you go. And that's crazy to me. And a quote I read by Friedkin when there was sort of a retrospective of this movie going on was that he was the camera operator in the car because the director of photography and camera operators both had kids and Friedkin didn't. And he said, like...
I did not hear that.
Yeah. Yeah, he said that he only did that because, you know, he was young and he wouldn't do that now, and nobody should ever do that. And, it's a pretty great story about that scene.
Yeah, and apparently one of the collisions wasn't scripted.
Yeah, which is awesome.
It just stayed in the movie.
Yeah,
that
was with the stunt driver, I think.
Yeah.
Because there were stunt drivers when Hackman was in the car.
Right.
And Hackman did do the majority of the driving, but I think, like, just a little over half. But that collision was with a stunt driver, and they just sort of kept it in. Apparently there were a lot of collisions, and but they only left the one in the movie. So, yeah.
What a crapshoot. This just sounds like madness, eh?
Yeah.
Just...
Nobody died. It worked out, though.
Crazy movie making in the 70s.
Yeah.
In New York. Oh, did you notice the World Trade Center?
No, I didn't.
This one?
No.
It's being constructed. You can see.
Really?
It's the first movie, like, feature film people know of with the World Trade Center. Like, one tower is completely constructed. The other one's about halfway through.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I did not notice that.
Just a little New York fun for you.
Hmm.
But you sound like you're big on this movie visually.
I'm always drawn to this sort of style, the type of realism type style. And I guess, like, the thing that this movie made me think of, and basically the style, is does a more documentary type feel inherently make a movie more exciting or a movie more interesting?
I don't know, because... That's a tough. I don't know if that works 100% of the time.
Okay.
I think it looks really good in this one, and I do enjoy those shots of the camera kind of right on the hood or on the bumper and things like that. But some of those wider, kind of longer shots that you get, I'm just thinking of that one collision that we were just talking about, especially. Yeah. That's how you would see an accident, like not cutting and not like a big close up, and, you know, I'm not just, you know, trying to be negative about modern movies cut so fast, blah blah blah, all this stuff, but. It is cool because that's in this movie. It looks like, you know, if you were in New York and just standing on a corner and this crazy thing started happening, like, this is the view you would have of it. Mm-hmm. And you kind of get these big shots of, you know, a camera coming into frame and sideswiping this car and all this stuff. And just, you know, the kind of stuff we've been touching on, but that documentary feel, if you weren't in this chase, but you happen to just see this chase, or if you've ever seen a car accident, like, that's what it looks like. You know, there's this whole world around it happening, not just this close up of the two pieces of metal colliding, you know?
And okay.
I think it is not a guarantee that, you know, that kind of documentary look is going to make things better. But in this movie, I think it absolutely works.
Okay. I think it it generally, for me, unless it's done poorly, I think, in which case it detracts. Like District 9, I had a problem with them. They basically ditched the documentary thing like 40 minutes into it.
Oh, yeah.
You never saw that movie, right?
No, okay.
Yeah, that movie, it was so interesting for 40 minutes, and then it's just like, no, crane shots. it's kind of brutal. But I think, like, in general, when a movie tries this type of style or a TV show, I just am so much more into it. Like, I'm trying to think of things that I've seen that are shot like this that I guess just hated. And I just can't think of anything. like Battle Los Angeles was the most, it was totally mediocre, but I, you know, I'm never going to watch it again, but I'm also not upset that I watched it. And that's probably the worst thing I could think of. Like Chronicle's out now. That's very much, it's sort of like Cloverfield. And Chronicle was awesome. Safe House, I was, I think is what?
No one is safe. No one is house.
No one is safe and Hugh Laurie isn't in this movie. Is that what you're saying?
Or if it's directed by Steven Spielberg, Safe Horse. moving on.
Yeah.
You may speak about Safe House.
Yeah, Safe House I think is just like, it's a totally pedestrian movie, but I liked it because of how it was shot.
Yeah.
And I think it was so much more engaging because of how it was shot. You know, and Narc, my favorite sequence of Narc, and Joe Carnahan directed Narc and has said that he loves The French Connection and loves William Friedkin. And the first scene in Narc is straight out of The French Connection. It's so amazing, though. But and just Narc in general is great. And I don't know, like Friday Night Lights. I love Friday Night Lights. And it, they sort of did the same thing as French Connection in that the actors would just do their thing and the camera would follow. That's how they did Friday Night Lights. And I think that adds authenticity to a performance, which I think adds authenticity to a movie. And I think that helps this movie with performances for sure. Yeah. I always find that way. But
maybe this wouldn't apply so much anymore because so many people do it. But especially then, I think it's a sign of a director who at least has earned some, like, some credibility to do some kind of off the wall things.
Well, I think in this case,
it's William Friedkin is well known and well respected by this point.
No, not by this point. This is what made him. He's got a tiny budget for this movie,
yeah,
and it's only because they have this budget that they were allowed to do this. You know, like it's sort of like the Bourne Identity. That was a big budget movie, and you don't really get the Greengrass style until the second movie because they had to make sure people were okay with it in the fight scenes and that it was a hit before you could do the Moscow chase scene, you know, and which is amazing because it's all handheld and the fight scene in the apartment and just in general. I mean, the Bourne Ultimatum is stellar, but I think you have to be really high up on the food chain or you have to be pretty like in the testing phase.
Yeah. Okay.
For this stuff to work, you know?
So. I want you to reconcile your love of the visuals with this movie with the zooms that are in this movie because
I'm
usually you rail against the zooms.
That's the thing. If you're putting it in the style, I'm okay with it.
Oh, okay.
I know the one you're always thinking of is that one in the Bourne Ultimatum Desh fight scene towards the end that I hate that you think I shouldn't have a problem with, right?
No, I just know you usually when we talk about, whenever I see a zoom, I think of how much you're probably like grinding your teeth watching this same
zoom. This time period zooms are generally okay. They're a little corny sometimes, but in this style, in this time period, it works. It's when there's like one power zoom in a movie or 1,000 power zooms that have like no, they're just like, we're zooming to zoom, you know, like, like Mission Impossible 2, which we recently talked about. That drove me crazy. The one in this isolated one in the Bourne Ultimatum drives me crazy because it's just one, like, don't just ever do one zoom and don't do way too many zooms is basically my rule. French Connection somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
Fine.
The one zoom that I enjoy, and I'm not like, you hate zooms and I love zooms. That's not the argument here. But we talked about it. It's when, he's at the table inside at the diner, and Popeye's outside, and they do they do that zoom from like, you know, the
inside
nice meal,
the restaurant,
inside to outside, and you know, I do like the things that we discussed earlier, how you see this, you know, the juxtaposition between the life that this cop has and this, you know, criminal, how awesome it can be and how bad being a cop can be at times, but I don't know, there's something about, and again, this is a visual thing that you'd probably be able to describe better than I can, but I love how they go from inside and then the zoom to outside. Like, you don't see that depth, I guess, is what it is. And how these two scenes, like, one right in front of the other. I really, really love that. And I do, again, like the other things, like, what that says thematically about the movie. But visually, just those two scenes, like, one in front of the other, and it goes right through the window and all comes into focus so well. I really enjoyed
it. Yeah, and, I mean, the reason it works for you is because it gets all of the themes of their relationship across.
Yeah.
Like the criminal-cop relationship.
Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah, visually and thematically, that was just one thing. In, like, 2 seconds, it was like, wow, okay.
No, that's a great
check shot. Check mark, okay. And, yeah, I think it just adds to the geography of the movie. And, you know, I think that goes back to kind of what I was saying about the chase scenes not always being so quick and so close up. You kind of get more of an idea of where this chase is going, and those bigger shots of the train turning and, you know, him looking at how he's going to have to go into the, you know, opposite lane and then back in, and yep. just the wider shots, I think it gives a good sense of actual space, mm-hmm. and I like that.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I agree.
That is all. Yeah, and as I said, you know, it's their relationship summed up pretty well there. And do you see this as kind of a case of morally at least ambivalent characters? Like maybe the good guy we've discussed isn't so good.
Yeah.
The bad guy doesn't, I mean, he's dealing drugs, but he seems to be kind of a nice, at least sophisticated civil person.
He's, you know, a sophisticated what I mean? Person. That doesn't make him a good person.
No, I know, but it's not, you know, it seems like they're trying to play with the positions a little bit, where the cop seems kind of racist, kind of single-minded and obsessive, whereas the bad guy is, you know, I know a classy villain is still a villain, yeah. but he's, you know, you don't see him doing a lot of terrible things, and
you don't see him doing terrible things, but in the long run, like, you look at all that heroin that he brought into yeah. to America. If that doesn't get seized, how many people does he kill?
Yeah. Know? Oh, and, you know, I think he's kind of responsible for some of the deaths in this movie, too.
Oh,
but
yeah, of course.
I'm just saying, they're kind of playing with those roles a little bit of good guy and bad guy.
Oh, yeah. No,
especially for the early 70s, too.
Yes, and I definitely agree. Popeye is not, you know, clearly on one side of the law at all times. You know,
yeah, like, and especially at the very ending, mm-hmm. and I don't like this part.
Okay.
But it's part of the movie, so I'll discuss it. It's when he shoots Mulderig.
Yep.
And the other cop that he doesn't get along with, but he doesn't mean to shoot him.
No.
He thinks it's somebody else. And then you find he doesn't really care at all.
Yep.
He seems to just be focused on still getting the drugs and everything.
Yep.
What do you make of that part, his kind of single-minded obsessiveness and complete lack of remorse for killing him? Well, yeah, we'll start that, with that.
That's it. I think it is. It's the obsessiveness, and I think that is, without that, I don't think the actual obsessiveness about the case is really driven home enough.
Okay,
like
I didn't
do
that.
About his obsession. And I think in that scenario, you know, you can mourn later. You can still catch Charnier, you know? Who's to say he wasn't very upset about this at some point, you know?
Yeah, it really doesn't seem to faze him.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I totally agree. And I'm speaking purely hypothetically. But
okay.
I'm sure he's not happy about killing a cop, but he also recognizes that I'm never going to be in the same building as Charnier again.
Yeah.
There's also probably. That. Yeah.
Okay. And so then he takes off after Charnier.
Yeah.
And there's a gunshot.
Mm-hmm. I don't like the gunshot. I think I love the end. I enjoy the way this movie ends, because most movies end 5 minutes later than they should, and this one ends a couple minutes earlier than it should, which I always like.
Okay.
But yeah.
I don't like the gunshot either.
Oh, yeah, I hate the gunshot.
So what's your explanation for it?
My problem with the gunshot is that we have no idea who he's shooting at, and it just, as opposed to leaving it open-ended, like, you know, where does Popeye go from here? It's sort of like, well, Popeye runs into this room and shoots somebody, and it's, who did he shoot or shoot at? It's not like, it sort of changes it from like, there could still be a scene going on in there, as opposed to, well, this chase is not ending, you know, it's sort of.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like you like the ambiguity of, like, you would like the ambiguity of.
If it just cut there with no gunshot sound, I'd love it. And I still kind of do, but, yeah. I don't, the gunshot, I don't like it at all.
Yeah, I don't like it.
And I love that as a last shot. I like it as a last shot, too.
Yeah, and I think that kind of, I don't know. I'm not always big on this is kind of a shock ending and just an open-ended, ambiguous ending a little bit.
I don't think it's a shock ending.
No?
No.
Okay. What do you think of the title cards about their future and then the movie's ending?
The thing that, and I didn't know this the first time I watched it, like years and years ago, and when it happened again, as I was sort of piecing together, you know, remembering, I forgot it's based on a true story. When I was watching the movie, I was just like, both times, I didn't know the first time I saw the movie that it was based on a true story. And as it cuts to those title cards, I'm like, well, that's a weird thing to do. Like, you don't need to explain that. Oh, based on a true story. Okay. Like, I just had no idea.
But they don't even get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the weirdest thing to me. Like, why do 75% of what really happened and then change the futures of the two cops?
Well, here's the thing about that to me. And throughout the director's commentary, William Friedkin is saying he's always talking about how authentic the movie is, how they shot in a documentary style. Like, we didn't have permits for anything. We were just rolling Rico Bravo around on a wheelchair to get our dolly shots, you know?
Yeah.
And, or Ricky Bravo, sorry, he calls him.
Rico Bravo's too good.
Yeah. Ricky Bravo's pretty amazing,
yeah,
too.
True.
But, yeah, Friedkin's always talking about how, you know, realistic the movie is until it becomes, until they change something about it, in which point he totally backs up and says, look, this is a movie that's about my impressions of the case. That's a quote he uses often. And that's why, that's where the movie is kind of troubling to me, because I think that's like, that's too much of a cop out for me. You can't just be like, well, we're shooting it like a documentary because this is a real story. Except for these parts that I changed,
yeah.
You know, and like when he's talking about the car chasing train sequence, which did not happen. He's saying, well, and we changed it to this because it's a movie and the movie needed a big action scene.
Yeah.
You know, like, and that just doesn't fly with me. You can't talk about the realism of something and then, and how realistic your movie is. And, in his defense, the, techniques and everything, from everything I know about police work, this is a fairly realistic movie to how they're doing surveillance and stuff like that. It glosses over a lot of it and just speeds it up, and there's just quick scenes of them playing cards. But generally, you know, like, Popeye Doyle doesn't act too much out of what I would expect a real cop to do, except when he's, you know, shooting people.
Yeah. that thing.
But yeah, and I just think there's a real problem there where you're talking about all this documentary stuff until you say something that wasn't true, you know? And then you're just like, well, I've got this as a defense, you know? And it's sort of, going back to the sticking with the authenticity thing, there's this movie coming out, or that will be out by the time this podcast is out, Act of Valor. Do you know this movie?
That rings a bell. Which one is that?
It's it is the movie with real Navy SEALs or whatever.
It's totally fiction, but real Navy SEALs and real technology and tactics and stuff, right?
It's based around real acts of valor, which I assume are really heroic things, you know? And the people playing these Marines or SEALs, whatever they are, I apologize to all of our Army listeners.
Yeah.
Gene Hackman, former Marine, by the way. Further backing up my point that he is a man.
He is.
Anyway.
He's enjoyable.
Love Gene
Seems like such a, like, not even a nice person, but like a real human being.
And he's the interview. I'll post the interview on the site that I read. It's a really interesting interview, and he's really reflective now, which I enjoy. But anyways, he's just writing historical fiction now. He's retired as an actor.
Like, four books with the like underwater archaeologist writing partner.
Go for it, man. But yeah, this movie Act of Valor. I mean, first, it makes me upset. Just like not even because I have to watch the trailer every time I go see a movie now, and it has been this way for a couple months, but it's basically financed. Isn't it financed by the government now? Cause it was made as a training vehicle. It was made as a training video with really high production values. And then they turned it into a movie to be released in the theaters.
That's awesome.
And so these SEALs are playing themselves doing, you know, and the tactics that they would use in these situations are as close as possible. And I was watching an interview with the directors for this movie that just made me so angry, because they were saying, we've created, a new type of film, the truly authentic action film.
Did they take the glass out of the window?
No, James Cameron wasn't present. And I mean, that sentence by itself upsets me, but then they went on to say that the movie is, based on, you know, a series, they listen to stories and series of acts of valor. And it's just all these things. And then they're like, and then we strung them together with a, you know, a conflict to make it a global thing. And it's just, and like, it's not really authentic. And it's like, I mean, the question, authentic is a weird word to break down, but like, they're talking about it's just the most realistic thing you can possibly experience. And, but the problem is they're doing all these things that really happened and then tying them in together with this giant big action save the world plot, which is totally fiction.
Yeah.
And, you know, they talk a lot about how they put people right in the middle of the raids. Like, they have a helmet cam that they show, and they do use a lot of handheld cinematography from what I've seen and promos and stuff. And it just upsets me a lot. And not even that, like, a propaganda movie is bothersome, but that they're acting like this is a real thing.
Yeah.
And people are gonna take it like dumb people are gonna see this and be like, I want to be Army, you know? Like, and how, like, in general, how do you feel about this movie's existence? You know?
Act of Valor?
Yeah.
I'm excited now. Okay. I only found out about this, like, 2 weeks ago, and it sounds wild.
It's, I don't know. And
can I say something about the
I'm certain it's going to be racist somehow, you know, like it's going to be like a villain. There's no way.
It's
like
a German bomb.
Exactly.
We have to get to it.
No, I'm
going to go off on Ramadan. What does this mean? This is all vaguely somehow racist.
They're celebrating their Roms and Doms, whatever that is. But I'm certain the villain's not going to be white. I'm certain he's going to have an accent. The trailer looks basically like The Expendables, but produced
less
by the
funny
government. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we don't need that when we have The Expendables coming out.
Mm. Well, yeah, The Expendables 2. Who knows what The Expendables 2 is about? Yeah.
Can I say something quick about fake things and otherwise real things?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm talking about. Like, at what point does talking about something like it's real become bad for you as a person? Like when William Friedkin is talking about this case, like, oh no, it was just an impression. Like, when does that become bad for you as a person when you're doing these things, when you're creating things and you're just playing fast and loose with the truth, but talking like it is the truth and then sort of backing out? That's a question.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a tough question. What I was going to mention was the hurricane,
the Reuben Carter
one. And I can't believe I forget this guy's name. He's one of those that guys. Who's the super racist cop in this one?
In this movie?
No, in the Hurricane.
I never saw Hurricane.
Oh, okay. So Hurricane, based on a true story.
Yeah.
But there. Oh, okay, that's why I don't understand. Okay, so there's the super duper racist cop in Hurricane who picks up Reuben Carter when he's a kid and is like, oh, I'm going to get you, boy. Like, yeah.
Okay. I hope this ends with you telling me that he is eventually arrested by the same
cop.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Okay, I may be making part of this up, but I know that there's absolutely a super racist fictional character inside the, like, the real story of him.
Yeah.
And I get that, you know, it is a movie and that sometimes you need to take shortcuts and throw a bunch of characters together to speed up the action or whatever, but it was just one of those things where I think part of the point of that movie was like, look how racist these times were.
Yeah.
And then when you do that and then you have to make things up about how racist these times were, it's just, I don't know, it seems really counterproductive to me and silly.
That's fair.
That's just what I was thinking about when you were talking about.
Okay, that's fine.
That.
And I guess like, because I mean, we seem to be in a world where it's getting easier and easier to sort of make up your own reality and sort of valiantly stick by it. Opinions are opinions now and you have to take them seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I see what you mean, where you're coming from. I think it's really tough to draw the line. And yeah, with Acts of Valor, because it's a propaganda thing, I think it makes it particularly touchy subject and sticky ground.
That's my other question. When does it become bad for society?
Yeah.
Because I think as a whole, like so many people doing that, playing fast and loose with the truth is generally bad.
Yeah.
I think as much as I love these movies with this sort of handheld style, I think it's probably not great for society in the long run, as subtle as that might be, but just sort of people thinking that the Bourne movies actually happened, or something like that. That's bad to me.
Yeah, and you think, okay, what is the tangible negative outcome of misrepresenting the truth in The French Connection? And, you know, it's hard to...
It's
a slippery slope.
That's basically the thing I'm saying. And this is a quote that I thought of just because it's in two of my favorite books and I think about it often because it's awesome. But it's from like this New York Magazine story by like Ron Suskin in 2004. And he's talking, it's about Bush administration and stuff like that. And I think I've brought this up on a podcast before. He's like we're an empire, in this Bush aide is talking about, you know, the country, we're an empire now, and when we act we create our own reality, and while you're studying that reality judiciously as you will act again, creating other new realities which you can study too, and that's how things will sort out. We're history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do. And he's talking like from the position of the administration that he was a part of, and
the position of making me pee my pants in fear.
Yeah, exactly.
That's terrifying.
And I mean, he was basically arguing with a journalist in that, and it's just like, I don't know. It's just there is no real set truth anymore, and that someone in the government is saying things like that is troubling me. And I'm just sort of like, I don't want my favorite type of filmmaking to just stop existing because, like, I love it. And,
yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know that it. I don't know. But I guess the big action movie, you could say the same things. Like, that's just bad.
Yeah.
You know, subtly, that's certainly not a good thing, that everything is about the world ending now, you know?
Yeah, but maybe that's one of the things you like about movies, is that used to be the analogy about people making, like, you know, you're making the reality when you make a movie, and people do that in real life maybe more often than you'd want.
Yeah, and yeah, I guess. And it does really sound like I'm giving... giving people in general short shrift here, like just basically calling people dumber than me, which I don't totally believe, but it's just, I guess I spend a lot of time on Twitter now, like reading trending topics and stuff like that. And I just feel, I get upset about people, things that people think are real and things that people think aren't real that are real.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just, I don't know.
Well, yeah. I remember on Microsoft Word, Xbox isn't a word, but PlayStation is. Yeah, and just you know, create your own reality.
Yeah, no, exactly.
People decide, you know, these people decide what's real, what's a real word.
Whereas I'm certain, real thing. If in Microsoft Word, I'm certain Xbox is a word, whereas PlayStation probably isn't. You know,
yeah, that's not what I said.
You switched it. You said PlayStation.
That's what I meant.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, and I guess I have a question for you then, more related to Gene Hackman, I suppose. Although I guess sort of
Hackman.
Yeah. Who, like, if you were
who? Jers.
It's not an activity, but I appreciate it.
I thought this was fill in the blank.
No. Yeah, the question is...
Spider-Man 3. No. Superman 3.
Isn't that the one he's not in?
I don't know.
I think that is. Okay. And, yeah, that's the one with Richard Pryor as the hacker. But anyways...
Hacker sounds like a nickname for Gene Hackman.
He was the star of Hackers, right? Him and Angelina Jolie. Anyways, yeah, okay. Let's say I'm asking you who do you think culture thinks is generally the best actors? And let's say, like, starting with Brando, because I think that's sort of where you have to start looking at modern actors.
Oh, like historically?
Yeah.
Laurence Olivier, people love.
Okay.
What's his name? Peter O'Toole? Isn't that a person?
Yep. I'm talking the general person, though.
Oh, okay.
I think Daniel Day-Lewis.
Daniel Day-Lewis. Yeah. I was kind of catching up. Oh, they're really good. Meryl Streep.
Yep.
Admiral Hackbar. Gene Hackman.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if who really gets...
Pacino. De Niro.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Look,
they get permanent life passes.
Yeah, yeah, they've got life passes. Hoffman, I think, fits in there.
Oh, yeah, people love him.
Yeah. The thing I think I generally... And Brando, I mean...
Yeah.
I think the thing that... I don't think the average person thinks of Gene Hackman like that, though. I don't think he thinks he's in that list. My point is, I think he absolutely belongs in that list, and I think he's great, but... Sorry, you...
No, I was just... I was looking over his... IMDb today, just his filmography, and I was like, I've always known about Gene Hackman. What movies have I seen? Like, what are his big movies?
Yeah,
like this, The French Connection, which is solid.
Yeah,
no doubts there. He was Lex Luthor, which, you know,
he's great as Lex Luthor.
I totally prefer Gene Hackman as a bad guy.
Okay, I guess I never asked you that question. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. And then, like,
you love Unforgiven.
Yeah, and Unforgiven. Yeah, I enjoy Unforgiven a lot, and I like him in it. But he doesn't have a lot of other big movies.
No, he doesn't. And I think something I like about Gene Hackman is that he's not afraid to do, you know, real commercial properties. Like, even outside of Superman, he did the Poseidon Adventure pretty much right after French Connection. Like,
once he established himself as an actor, got Best Actor, and it's like, okay, I'm a leading man, I can choose what I want. Yeah. Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah, exactly. And but, you know, he's in some really good movies. I haven't seen The Conversation in years, but I always loved it. Royal Tenenbaums, pretty good movie. Enemy of the State is better than anyone would think about on the surface.
You love Enemy of the State.
Yeah, we're gonna do a podcast on The Conversation, Enemy of the State, because it's so good.
Have you seen The Quick and the Dead?
Yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah, I didn't think you would. He's the bad guy in that.
Okay, yeah. I haven't seen that in a long time. But I think part...
You'd like it even less now.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, my God. Yeah.
And I think part of the reason Hackman gets left off, so, or, you know, isn't generally considered one of the greatest actors of his generation, whereas I think he at least belongs on that list, you know, is that he's just good in everything. And there, but he doesn't have, like, his most iconic role is French Connection, which is probably something that's sort of fallen by the wayside because the rest of the 70s was pretty great for film, or at least the next few years of the 70s. And I think it's sort of that he just always fits perfectly into whatever it is that the movie is.
So you don't see him as Gene Hackman?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's just sort of, like I've been mentioning, that he just seems like a real, we've talked about how he seems like a real person, and he always sort of fits into his roles, and he just seems like just such an authentic actor, and that's how we're able to sort of forget about him, you know?
And, well, yeah, and it's weird. Like, every once in a while, people come by, and maybe it's that they're such a good actor, but just something about them seems almost like you've met them before. Like, you're just like, this is a person. Like, yep. This is a whole person.
Yep.
And maybe he's just such a phenomenal actor, and that's what it is to me. But he's one of those people where I think he's a very real person.
Yeah.
And I obviously have never met him and never talked to him or anything like that. But, yeah, some of these people just seem like people you would meet who now they just happen to be in these movies.
Yeah. And I guess I'm really curious to see what happens when... I mean, this is kind of morbid, but when he dies, like, he's 82 now,
and he retired. Like,
he retired in 2004,
yeah.
And nobody really mentions him. Like, when that GQ interview, I got so excited when I found it because he just talks about his fiction mostly now, and this was kind of an interesting sort of life-spanning interview. But and it's, people don't seem to realize that he even retired. You know, which is
he's just kind of crazy. Someone who's always been there.
Yeah, exactly.
And I know about.
And he had a bike accident in January or whatever. That was sort of, it apparently seemed, well, for one, if you're 82 and on a bike, that's pretty wicked. But it seemed initially on Twitter, it seemed super serious and like that he was getting airlifted, but it ended up just sort of being like fender bender type thing. But it made me sort of curious as to how people are going to talk about Gene Hackman when he dies.
Yeah.
Because I mean, general rule, everybody that has done anything good in their life gets their position elevated when they die.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if he gets mentioned as an actor in that list when he dies, or if he's sort of someone that remains just one of the great untalked about actors. You know?
Yeah, I think when he does die, they're definitely going to throw his name around with kind of that.
And he's worked with some people that... He was Dustin Hoffman's roommate, you know, and Robert Duvall. The three of them were good friends together, and he's going to get some really kind words from some really cool people.
Absolutely.
And I'm curious to see what that does for his legacy. And because I think his legacy should be better than it is. And I think this might be one of the rare occasions where his death will lift him up to where he should be, as opposed to being lifted above where he should be where he is now as a dead person.
And sneaking Royal Tenenbaums at the end of their career there.
It's amazing. Like, his performance is so good in that
movie. Yeah, and now it's not, people aren't just going to say, like, oh, he stopped making movies, like, 2 decades ago. You know what I mean? This totally just bookends it, where he started, you know, not started with the French Connection, but that was his first big, big, big thing.
Yeah, well, he was in Bonnie and Clyde. The French Connection is his first big...
Leading role. He got, like, he got nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Bonnie and Clyde.
And he's really great in Bonnie and Clyde. And I think, I mean, part of my argument is that he was in great movies in the 60s, the 70s. I guess it depends on how much you like Hoosiers. I don't particularly care for it, so I can't think of anything in the 80s that it counts for. But you got the 90s. I think Enemy of the State is a great movie, and I think he's great in it. But yeah, you've got The Conversation and French Connection in the 70s. And in 2000, I think, was Royal Tenenbaums, and that's 4 different decades with great movies and great performances, which not a lot of actors can say.
Yeah, and Wes Anderson's going to be remembered really well, and so will Royal Tenenbaums. And yeah, for him to get that performance in at the end of the career, absolutely just one in every decade pretty much for a while. And yeah, I think he will be remembered very well. And as you said, maybe to the point where he should be.
So, Gene Hackman, I apologize that we're talking about you like you're already dead. But we do love you quite a bit. So,
and overall, for me at least, French Connection, good.
Yeah.
Go see it.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Really don't like the ending.
That's fine.
But overall,
yeah.
Thumbs up.
Yeah. Okay.
Whatever the French word for thumb is. I don't know.
Fair enough.
Oh, by the way,
yeah.
Because this movie has French in the title, you need to see a baguette in the first 6 minutes. No, and you absolutely do.
No, it's so funny. When Friedkin's talking about that part in the commentary, William Friedkin's like, okay, and we start the movie with this French detective who's following Charnier, and he finishes his day of surveillance, and he gets a baguette, because of course he's French. That's exactly what he says. Okay, maybe not exactly, but that's a very close paraphrasing to what he says, and I don't know if he means that with because he's in a movie about a French person that he has to get a baguette, or because he's a French person that he has to get a baguette.
Oh, I was so happy about that.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. And I'm even happier now that I've heard how he feels about it.
Yeah. So let's go out on a laugh. Thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man. This episode hasn't been brought to you by Ron Swanson. I don't have to know what a podcast is to know that it isn't worth my time. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.